alternative, surely. And again his mother answered, "Nothing at all, apparently, aside from selling the house and park completely. And even Roderick feels that that's not to be thought of, not after we've given up so much already in order to hang on to it. We'll make it a condition of the sale that Bab puts up a fence around the building work, and then at least we won't have to look at it." Now Roderick did speak. He said thickly, "Yes, we must have a fence to keep out the mob. Not that that will stop them, mind. They'll soon be scaling the walls of the house at night with cutlasses between their teeth. You'd better sleep with a pistol under your pillow, Caroline."
"They're not pirates, you oaf," she murmured, without looking up from her plate.
"Aren't they? I'm not so sure. I think they'd like nothing better than to hang us all from the main brace. They're just waiting for Atlee to give them the word. He probably will, too. Ordinary people hate our sort now, don't you see?"
"Please, Roderick," said Mrs. Ayres uncomfortably. "Nobody hates our sort. Not in Warwickshire."
"Oh, especially in Warwickshire. Over the border in Gloucestershire they're still feudal at heart, but Warwickshire people have always been good business people right back to the days of the Civil War. They were all for Cromwell then, don't forget. Now they can see which way the wind is blowing. I wouldn't blame them if they decided to chop off our heads. We certainly put up a pretty poor show of saving ourselves." He made a clumsy gesture. "Just look at Caroline and me, prize heifer and prize bull. We're hardly doing our bit to further the herd. Anyone would think we were going out of our way to make ourselves extinct."
"Rod," I said, seeing the look on his sister's face. He turned to me.
"What? You ought to be glad. You're from pirate stock, aren't you? You don't think you'd have been invited along tonight otherwise? Mother's too embarrassed to let any of our real friends see us as we are now. Hadn't you figured that out yet?"
I felt myself blush, but more in anger than anything else, and I wouldn't give him the satisfaction of showing any other discomfort, but kept my eyes on his as I ate, wanting to stare him out, one man to another. The tactic worked, I think, for he met my gaze with a flutter of his lashes, and just for a moment he looked ashamed and somehow desperate, like a boasting boy secretly daunted by his own bravado. Caroline had lowered her head and went on with her dinner. Mrs. Ayres said nothing for a minute or two, then set her knife and fork together, and when she spoke again it was to ask after another patient of mine, as if our earlier conversation had had no interruption. Her manner was smooth, her voice quite soft. She didn't look at her son after that. Instead she seemed to cut him from the table, to plunge him into darkness, just as if she were reaching and snuffing out the candles in front of him one by one. The dinner by then was beyond recovery. The dessert was a bottled raspberry pie, slightly sour, served with artificial cream. The room, after all, was damp and chill. The wind was moaning in the chimney. The table, not the sort of pre-war one it was possible to linger over, even if the mood had been better. Mrs. Ayres told Betty that we would take our coffee in the little parlour, and she, Caroline, and I rose and put down our napkins. Only Rod hung back. At the door he said moodily,
"I shan't come with you. I'm sure you won't mind. I've some papers I need to look over."
"Cigarette papers, I suppose," said Caroline, going down the passage to open the door to the little parlour for her mother.
Roderick blinked at her, and again I had the feeling that he was trapped in his own bad humour and secretly abashed by it. I watched him turn away from us to begin the short, gloomy journey to his room, and I felt a rush of angry pity for him. It seemed brutal of us to let him go, but I joined his mother and sister, and found them adding wood to the little parlour fire.
"I must apologise for my son, doctor," said Mrs. Ayres as she sat.
She put the back of her wrist to her temple as if her head ached.
"His behaviour to-night was unforgivable. Can't he see how unhappy he makes us all? If he means to start drinking now, on top of everything, I shall have to ask Betty to keep back the wine. I never saw his father drunk at the table. I hope you know how very welcome you are in this house. Will you sit here, across from me?"
I did sit, for a time. Betty brought us our coffee, and we talked more about the sale of the land. I asked them again if there were no alternative, pointing out the disruption that the building work would lead to, and the impact such a thing would inevitably have on life at the Hall. But they had thought it through already, and had evidently surrendered themselves to the idea.
Even Caroline seemed curiously passive about it all. So I thought I would try Roderick again. It was bothering me, too, to picture him alone and unhappy on the other side of the house. Once my coffee was finished, I put down my cup and said I would just look in on him to see if I could be any help with his work. As I'd suspected, the work was all bluff. When I went in, he was sitting more or less in darkness, with only the fire to light the room. I hadn't knocked this time so as not to give him the opportunity of refusing me, and he turned his head and said sulkily, "I thought you'd come." "May I join you for a while?"
"What do you think? You can see how frightfully busy I am. No, don't put on the light. I've rather a headache."
I heard him setting down a glass and moving forward.
"I'll stoke this up a bit instead. God knows it's cold enough for it."
He caught up a couple of pieces of log from the box beside the fireplace and flung them clumsily into the hearth. They sent sparks flying up the chimney and cinders leaping out of the grate and had the effect, for a moment or two, of damping the fire and making the room even darker. But by the time I had picked my way over to him and drawn up the other armchair, the flames were beginning to lap and crackle around the damp, raw wood, and I could see him clearly. He had slouched back in his chair and stuck out his legs. He was still in his evening clothes, his woolen waistcoat and fingerless gloves, but he had loosened his tie and taken out a collar stud so that one side of the collar sprang up like a comedy drunk's. This was the first time I had been in his room since he had told me that fantastic story in my dispensary, and as I sat I found myself glancing uneasily around. Away from the light of the fire the shadows were so thick and so shifting as to be almost impenetrable, but I could just make out the rumpled blankets of his bed, with, beside it, his dressing-table, and, close to that, his marble-topped washing-stand. Of the shaving-glass, which I'd last seen sitting on the stand along with his razor and soap and brush, there was no sign. By the time I looked back at Roderick, he'd begun fiddling in his lap with papers and tobacco, rolling himself a cigarette. Even in the shifting glow of the firelight, I could see that his face was flushed and thick with drink. I began to talk, as I'd intended, about the sale of the land, leaning forward, speaking earnestly, trying to get some sense into him. But he turned his head and wouldn't listen. At last I gave the subject up. Sitting back, I said instead, "You look terrible, Rod." That made him laugh.
"Ha! I hope that's not a professional opinion. I'm afraid we can't afford it."
"Why are you doing this to yourself?" "The estate's falling to pieces around you, and look at you. You've had gin, vermouth, wine, and—" I nodded to his glass, which was sitting on a mess of papers on the table at his elbow. "What's in there? Gin again?" He cursed quietly.
"Jesus! What of it? Can't a bloke get lit up now and then?"
I said, "Not a bloke in your position, no."
"What position's that? Lord of the manor?"
"Yes, if you want to put it like that." He licked the gum of his cigarette paper, looking sour.
"You're thinking of my mother."
"Your mother would be miserable," I said, "if she saw you like this."
"Do me a favour, then, old chap, will you? Don't tell her."
He put the cigarette into his mouth and lit it with a newspaper spill from the fire.
"Anyway," he said as he sat back, "it's a bit late for her to begin acting the devoted matron. 24 years too late, to be exact. 26 in Caroline's case."
I said, "Your mother loves you dearly. Don't be stupid."
"You know all about it, of course."
"I know what she's told me."
"Yes, you're great chums, you and she, aren't you? What has she told you? How frightfully disappointed I've made her? She's never forgiven me, you know, for letting myself get shot down and lamed. We've been disappointing her all our lives, my sister and I. I think we disappointed her simply by being born."
I didn't answer, and for a time he was silent, gazing into the fire. And when he spoke again, it was in a light, almost casual tone. He said,
"Did you know I ran away from school when I was a boy?"
I blinked at the change of subject. "No," I said reluctantly, "I didn't know that."
"Oh, yes. They kept it quiet, but I bolted twice. The first time I was only 8 or 9. I didn't get far. The second time, though, I was older, maybe 13. I just walked out. No one stopped me. I got as far as the public bar of an hotel. I telephoned Morris, my father's chauffeur, and he came and got me.
He was always a pal of mine. He bought me a ham sandwich and a glass of lemonade, and we sat at a table and talked it through. I had thought it all out. I knew he had a brother who ran a garage, and I had £50 of my own, and I thought I might go shares in the garage, live with the brother and be a mechanic. I really knew, you see, about engines.
He drew on his cigarette.
Morris was awfully good about it. He said, "Will Master Roderick," he had the most terrible Birmingham accent, just like that, "Will Master Roderick, I think you'd make a fine mechanic, and my brother would be honoured to have you. But don't you think it would break your parents' heart, you being heir to the estate and all?" He wanted to take me back to school, but I wouldn't let him. He didn't know what else to do with me, so he brought me back here and gave me to Cook, and Cook got me quietly up to my mother. They were imagining that Mother would look after me, make things easy with the old man, like mothers do in the pictures and on the stage. But no, she just told me what a great disappointment I was, and she sent me down to Father to explain to him for myself what I was doing here. The old man ramped like the devil, of course, and thrashed me. Thrashed me right by the open window where any outdoors servant could have seen. He laughed, and I had only run away because a boy was thrashing me at school. A beastly boy he was, Hugh Nash. He used to call me Airs and Graces, but even he had the decency to whip me in private.
His cigarette was burning itself out in his fingers, but he sat still and his voice dipped.
Nash went into the Navy in the end. He was killed off Malaya, and you know, when I heard he'd been killed, I felt relieved. I was already in the Air Force by then, and I felt relieved, just as if I were still at school. Another boy had told me that Nash had been taken out of class by his parents. Poor Morris died, too, I think. I wonder if his brother did all right.
His voice grew harsh.
I wish I had gone shares in that garage. I'd be a happier man than I am now, pouring everything I've got into this bloody estate. Why the hell am I doing it? For the sake of the family, you're going to say, with that wonderful insight of yours. Do you really think this family's worth saving? Look at my sister. This house has sucked the life out of her, just as it's sucking it out of me. That's what it's doing. It wants to destroy us. All of us. It's all very well my standing up to it now, but how long do you think I can go on like that? And when it's finished with me...
"Rod, stop it," I said, for his voice had risen suddenly and he was becoming agitated. Realizing his cigarette had gone out, he'd leaned forward to put another paper spill to the fire, and he had thrown the spill violently down so that it bounced back over the marble fender and lay burning at the edge of the rug. I picked it up and tossed it into the grate. Then, seeing the state of him, I reached for the edge of the fire curtain, for his was one of those fireplaces that had a piece of fine old mesh hung across it like a nursery guard, and drew it closed. He sat back in his chair, his arms folded defensively. He took one or two furtive puffs on his cigarette, then tilted his head and began to glance around the room, his eyes seeming very large and dark in his lean, pale face. I knew what he was watching for, and felt almost sick with frustration and dismay. There had been no mention of the old delusion before this. His behaviour had been troubling, unpleasant, but rational enough. But I could see now that nothing had changed. His mind was still clouded. The drinking, perhaps, was simply to give him courage, and the truculence was a desperate form of bluster. He said, with his gaze still moving,
"There'll be tricks tonight. I can sense it. I have a feeling for it now. I'm like a weather vane. I start twitching when the wind's on the turn."
He spoke almost lugubriously, so that I couldn't tell how much of this was theatrics, how much was in deadly earnest. But it was impossible to resist. I found my gaze following his. Again my eye was drawn to the washing stand. This time, too, I tilted back my head to look at the ceiling above it. I could just make out through the darkness that peculiar stain or smudge, and then my heart sank as I spotted a yard or so from it a similar mark. Further off I thought I saw another. I looked at the wall behind Rod's bed and saw one there, or thought I did. I couldn't be sure. The shadows played such tricks. But my gaze went darting about from one surface to another until it seemed to me that the room might be teeming with those mysterious smudges. And suddenly the thought of leaving Rodamongle for another night, another hour, was too much. I drew my eyes away from the darkness and leaned forward out of my chair to say urgently, "Rod, come back to Lidcote with me, will you?"
"To Lidcote?
I think you'll be safer there."
"I can't leave now. I told you, didn't I? The wind's on the turn."
"Stop talking like that." He blinked as if in sudden understanding. He tilted his head again and said almost coyly,
"You're afraid."
"Rod, listen to me.
You can feel it, can't you? You can feel it and you're afraid. You didn't believe me before. All that talk of nerve storms, of war shock. Now you're more frightened than I am."
I was afraid, I realized. Not of the things he'd been babbling about, but of something vaguer and more dreadful. I reached to try and catch hold of his wrist.
"Rod, for God's sake, I think you're in danger."
The action startled him. He moved back. And then, it was the drink, I suppose, he flew into a rage.
"God damn you!"
he cried, pushing me away.
"Get your hands off me! Don't you fucking well tell me how to behave? That's all you ever do. And when you're not doling out your doctor's advice, you're making a grab at me with your filthy doctor's fingers. And when you're not grabbing, you're watching, watching with your filthy doctor's eyes. Who the fucking hell are you, anyway? Why the hell are you here? How did you manage to get such a footing in this house? You're not a part of this family. You're no one."
He thumped his glass down on the table so that the gin slopped over the papers.
"I'm calling for Betty," he said absurdly, "to see you out."
He moved clumsily to the chimney breast and caught hold of the lever which worked the call bell, jerking and jerking it, so that we could hear the faint, hectic clanging of it down in the basement. It sounded bizarrely like the bell that the village air raid wardens had used to ring, and it added an extra atavistic flutter of agitation to the shock and upset which had already begun to swirl inside me at his words. I rose and went across to the door and opened it just as, breathless and startled, Betty appeared. I tried to keep her from coming in. I said, "It's all right, nothing's wrong. There's been a mistake. Go back downstairs." But,
"Dr. Faraday's leaving, Betty," called Roderick over my words. "He has other patients to see. Isn't that a pity? Take him out to the hall, will you, and pick up his coat and his hat on the way."
The girl and I looked at each other, but what on earth could I do? I myself had reminded Rod a few minutes before that he was the head of the household, a grown man, master of the estate and its servants. I said stiffly at last, "Very well." She stepped aside so that I could pass her, and then I heard her hurrying off to fetch my things. I felt so agitated now, I actually had to stand for a minute at the little parlour door to collect myself, and when finally I went in I was still so shaken I imagined my face or manner would betray me at once. But my entrance impressed no one. Caroline had an open novel in her lap, and Mrs. Ayres, in her chair beside the fire, was frankly snoozing. That gave me another jolt. I had never seen her sleeping before, and when I went over to her and she woke, she looked at me, briefly, with what might have been the frightened, unmoored gaze of a bewildered old woman. She had placed a shawl across her lap, and it was slipping to the floor. I bent to retrieve it, and by the time I had straightened up she could take it from me and tuck it back around her knees herself again. She asked me how Roderick was. I hesitated, then said, "Not wonderful, to be honest. I wish I knew what to say. Caroline, you might look in on him in a minute or two."
"Not if he's drunk," she answered. "He's too boring."
"And
drunk," said Mrs. Ayres, with a touch of scorn. "Thank goodness his grandmother isn't alive to see him. The Colonel's mother, I mean. She always said there was nothing more depressing than the sight of a man in liquor. I must say I agree with her. As for my own mother's side, I think my great-grandparents were temperance people. Yes, I'm almost sure they were."
"Still," I said, looking hard at Caroline, "you might just pay your brother a visit before you go to bed, to assure all's well." She at last caught the meaning behind my words and looked up to meet my gaze. She closed her eyes in a weary gesture, but gave me a nod. That reassured me a little, but I was quite unable to sit calmly beside the fire and talk of ordinary things. I thanked them for my supper and said good night. Betty was waiting out in the hall with my hat and overcoat. and the sight of her brought Rod's words back to me. "Who the hell are you? You're no one." Outside, the weather was still filthy and seemed to whip up my mood. The upset and anger grew on me as I drove home, so that I drove badly, clashing the gears, once taking a curve too sharply and very nearly running the car off the road. In an effort to calm myself down, I worked on various bills and papers until well past midnight, but when I finally went to bed I lay fretful, almost hoping for a call to a patient, to take my mind away from the snag of my own thoughts. No call came. And at last I switched on the lamp and got up to pour myself a drink. On my way back to bed I caught sight of that old photograph of the hall, in its handsome tortoise-shell frame. I had kept it out all this time, together with that Empire Day medal, on my bedside table. I picked it up and looked at my mother's face. Then I shifted my gaze to the house behind her, and, as I'd sometimes done before, I thought of the people inside it now, wondering if they were lying more restfully than I was in their chill, dark, separate rooms. Mrs. Ayres had given me the picture in July, and it was now early December. How on earth, I asked myself, had my life in those few months become so tangled with that family's as to trouble and unsettle me like this? With the alcohol inside me my anger blunted, and eventually I slept. But I slept badly, and while I lay tussling with dark, violent dreams, something dreadful happened out at Hundreds Hall. Chapter 7. The story, as I pieced it together afterwards, was this. Once I left the house, Mrs. Ayres and Caroline stayed in the little parlour for just over an hour, and during that hour, feeling slightly uneasy after what I'd hinted to her, Caroline went in to check on Rod. She found him sprawled, open-mouthed, nursing an empty gin bottle, too drunk to speak, and her first reaction, she said, was one of annoyance. She was very tempted simply to leave him there to stew in his chair. But then he gazed blearily up at her, and there was something in his eyes that moved her, some spark of his former self. For a moment she was almost overcome with the hopelessness of their situation. She knelt beside him and took his hand, lifting it to her face and resting her brow against his knuckles. "What's happened to you, Roddy?" she asked him quietly. "I don't know you. I miss you. What's happened?" He moved his fingers against her cheek, but didn't or couldn't answer. She stayed at his side for another few moments, then, pulling herself together, decided to put him into his bed. She guessed he needed the lavatory, so she got him to his feet and sent him off to the gentleman's hoo-ha along the passage. And when he'd come lurching back, she took off his shoes and his collar and got him out of his trousers. She was used to helping him in and out of his clothes from having nursed him after his accident, so this sort of thing was nothing to her. She said he more or less passed out the moment his head touched his pillow, and then he lay snoring and reeking horribly of drink. He was lying on his back, and that made her remember some wartime training and try to heave him over onto his side in case he should be sick. But he resisted all her efforts, and finally, tired and frustrated, she gave them up. She made sure he was well covered with blankets before she left him, and she went to the fire, drew back the mesh guard, and added more wood. She closed the guard again when she had finished. She was later quite certain of that, and she was equally certain that no cigarettes were burning in any of the ashtrays, and that no lamps or candles were lit. She returned to the little parlour, where she spent another half hour with her mother. They went to bed well before midnight. Caroline read for 10 or 15 minutes, before putting out her light, and she fell asleep almost at once. She was woken a few hours later, around 3:30 as it turned out, by the faint but distinctive sound of breaking glass. The sound came from just below her own windows, that is, from one of the windows of her brother's room. Startled, she sat up in bed. She assumed that Rod had woken and was blundering about, and her one thought was to prevent him from coming upstairs and disturbing their mother. She got wearily to her feet and put on her dressing gown. She was just nerving herself up to go downstairs and deal with him when it occurred to her that the sound might not have been made by her brother at all, but might have come from a burglar trying to force a way into the house. Perhaps she was remembering Rod's words about pirates and cutlasses. Anyway, she went softly across to her window, put back the curtain, and looked out. She saw the garden, bathed in a leaping yellow light, and smelt smoke, and realized that the house was on fire. Fire is a thing that is always dreaded in a great house like Hundreds Hall. Once or twice in the old days there had been small kitchen fires which had fairly easily been put out. During the war Mrs. Ayres had had a constant fear of air raids, and buckets of sand and water and hoses and stirrup pumps had been left out on every floor, and as it turned out, were never needed. Now those pumps had been put away. There were no mechanical extinguishers. There was only, hanging up in one of the basement passages, a line of ancient leather pails, bloomy with age and probably leaky, kept there more for picturesque value than anything else. It was a wonder that Caroline, knowing all this and seeing the dancing yellow light, did not panic. Instead, she confessed to me later that, for a single, wild moment, what she felt was a sort of excitement. She thought of all the problems that would be solved if the hall were simply to burn to the ground. She had a vision of the work she had done on the house in the past few years, all the wooden floors and panels she had polished, all the glass, all the plate. And instead of resenting the fire for threatening to snatch these things from her, she wanted to give them all up in a sort of orgy of surrender. Then she remembered her brother. She caught up the rug from before her hearth and the blankets from her bed and went racing out to the staircase, calling wildly to her mother as she went. Downstairs in the hall the smell of smoke grew stronger. In the passage the air was already soupy and beginning to prickle at her eyes. She ran through the boot room to the gentleman's lavatory to douse the rug and blankets with water at the basin. She found the call bell and rang on it, much, I suppose, as I'd seen Roderick ringing a few hours before. By the time she had gathered together the sodden blankets and gone staggering out with them, a frightened-looking Betty had appeared at the curtained arch, barefoot and in her nightdress.
"Bring water!" Caroline called to her. "There's a fire! Can't you smell it? Bring your bedclothes! Bring anything, quickly!"
And hoisting the wet blankets higher against her breast, she ran panting and sweating to Roderick's room. She began to cough and catch at her breath, she said, even before opening the door. When she went in, the smoke was so thick and so stinging she was reminded of a gas practice chamber she had once been sent into during her time in the Wrens. Then, of course, she had had a respirator with her. The point of the exercise was to put it on. Now she could do nothing but bury her nose and mouth in the wet bundle in her arms and fight her way forward. The heat was already terrific. She could see flames on every side of the room. There seemed to be fire everywhere, so that for one desperate moment she thought she was beaten and would have to turn back. But then she did turn, and lost her bearings, and grew sick with absolute panic. She saw flames close beside her, and wildly flung her blankets at them. She began to beat at another patch of fire with the rug, and soon she became aware of Betty and her mother beating with blankets of their own. The smoke billowed and briefly thinned, and she caught a glimpse of Roderick on the bed where she had left him, dazed and coughing as if just coming to. Two of the brocade curtains at the windows were alight. Two others had burned almost completely and were in the process of falling away. She was able to force a path to them and reach between them to fling open the glass doors. I shuddered when she told me this, for had the fire's grip on the room been much stronger, the sudden rush of cold air would surely have been fatal. But the flames at that point must have already been under control, and the night, thankfully, was still a damp one. Caroline helped a staggering Roderick out onto the stone steps, and then went back to see to her mother. The smoke was clearing, she said, but the room as she plunged back into it was like some small scene from hell. Unimaginably hot, lit up at a thousand diabolical points, and thick with whirling embers and tongues of fire that seemed to dart viciously at her face and hands. Mrs. Ayres was coughing and gasping for breath, her hair wild, her nightdress filthy. Betty had begun to bring pans of water, and the ash and smoke and smouldering fragments of carpet, blanket and paper were turning to pools of thick black sludge beneath the three women's feet. They worked on the room for far longer, probably, than they really needed to, for at first they would beat out a patch of flame only to turn their backs on it and find that, a few minutes later, it had begun to glow again. So after that they took no chances and made their grim, methodical way from one ruined surface to another, pouring water and using pokers and fire tongs to riddle up and beat out embers and sparks. They were all three of them, sick and wheezing from the smoke, with running eyes which left pale tear marks on their soot-stained cheeks. And soon they found themselves shivering, partly in response to the drama of it all, partly simply with the cold, which seemed to rise up in the hot room with appalling swiftness, the moment the last flame was doused. Roderick, apparently, kept at the open window clinging to the frame. He was still very drunk, but added to that, and not surprisingly, I suppose, bearing in mind everything he'd been through during the war, the sight of the flames and the choking smoke seemed to paralyze him. He looked on wildly, but uselessly, as his mother and sister made the room safe. He let himself be helped indoors, but by the time they had got him down to the kitchen and put him to sit at the table with a blanket around him, he had begun to understand just how near they had all come to disaster, and he clutched at his sister's hand.
"You see what's happened, Caro?" he said to her. "You see what it wanted? My God, it's cleverer than I thought. If you hadn't woken, if you hadn't come—"
"What is he saying?"
asked Mrs. Ayres, distressed by his manner and not understanding.
"Caroline, what does he mean?"
"He doesn't mean anything,"
answered Caroline, knowing full well what he meant, but wanting to protect her mother from it.
"He's still drunk. Roddy, please."
But now, she said, he started acting like a madman, putting the heels of his hands to his eyes, then catching at his hair, then looking in horror at his fingers, for his hair had oil on it, and the oil had turned, in the smoke, to a gritty sort of tar. He wiped his hands on his blackened shirt front, compulsively. He began to cough, and then to struggle for his breath, and the struggling sent him into one of his panics. He reached for Caroline again.
"I'm sorry,"
he kept saying, over and over. His breath was ragged and boozy. His eyes were crimson in his sooty face. His shirt was soaked through with rainwater. He grabbed with shaking hands at his mother.
"Mother, I'm sorry."
After their ordeal in the burning room, his behavior was too much. Mrs. Ayres looked at him for a second in absolute horror, then,
"Be quiet,"
she cried, her voice breaking.
"Oh, for God's sake, be quiet."
And when he still babbled and wept, Caroline went to him and swung back her hand and struck him. She said she felt the sting of it in her palm almost before she knew that she had done it, and then she put her hands to her mouth, as startled and as frightened as if it were she herself who'd been hit. Rod abruptly fell silent and covered his face. Mrs. Ayres stood watching him, her shoulders twitching as she caught after her breath. Caroline said unsteadily,
"We're all a little mad, I think. We're all a little crazy. Betty, are you there?"
The girl came forward, her eyes wide, her face pale and striped like a tiger's with streaks of soot. Caroline said,
"You're all right?"
Betty nodded.
"Not burnt, or anything like that?"
"No, miss."
She spoke in a whisper, but the sound of her voice was reassuring, and Caroline grew calmer.
"Good girl. You've been very good, and very brave. Don't mind my brother. He isn't himself. We're none of us ourselves. Is there any hot water? Light the boiler, will you, and put some pans on the stove? Enough for tea and three or four washbowls. We can take off the worst of the muck before we go up to the bathroom. Mother, you should sit down."
Mrs. Ayres looked vague. Caroline went around the table to help her into a chair and to tuck a kitchen blanket around her, but her own limbs trembled as she did it. She felt as nerveless, suddenly, as if she'd been lifting impossible weights, and when her mother was settled, she drew out a chair for herself and sank heavily into it. For 5 or 10 minutes after that, the only sounds in the kitchen were the roars of flame at the stove, the rising stir of warming water, and the clink of metal and china as Betty went about setting down bowls and gathering towels. Presently the girl called softly to Mrs. Ayres. She helped her over to the sink, where she washed her hands, her face, and her feet. She did the same for Caroline, then looked doubtfully at Rod. He, however, had calmed himself down sufficiently to see what was wanted of him and to stumble over to the sink. But he moved like a sleepwalker, putting his hands into the water and letting Betty soap and rinse them, then standing limp and staring while she wiped the smudges from his face. His tarry hair resisted all attempts to wash it. She took a comb to it instead, catching the crumbs of cindery oil in a sheet of newspaper, then screwing the paper up and setting it down on the draining board. When she had finished, he moved dumbly to one side to let her pour the filthy water down the sink. He looked across the kitchen and caught his sister's eye, and his expression was such a mixture, Caroline said, of fear and confusion, she couldn't bear it. She turned away from him, meaning to rejoin her mother. Then a very strange thing happened. Caroline had just taken a step towards the table when, from the very corner of her eye, she saw her brother make some movement, something as simple, she thought at the time, as putting up his hand to his face to bite at a fingernail or to rub at his cheek. At the same moment Betty also moved, turning briefly away from the sink to drop a towel into a bucket on the floor, but as she turned back, The girl gave a gasp. Caroline looked properly, and, to her absolute amazement, saw beyond her brother's shoulder more flames.
"Roddy!"
she called, afraid. He turned, saw what she had seen, and darted away. On the wooden draining board, a few inches from where he had been standing, there was a small bundle of fire and smoke. It was the newspaper which Betty had used to catch the cinders from his hair, and which she had screwed into a loose sort of parcel, and which now, somehow, unbelievably, had managed to set itself alight. The fire was nothing, of course, compared to the terrifying small inferno they had tackled in Roderick's room. Caroline went quickly across the kitchen and knocked the bundle into the sink. The flames rose higher, then rapidly dwindled. The blackened paper, gossamer-like, held its shape for a moment before collapsing into fragments. But the dumbfounding thing was how such a fire could have started at all. Mrs. Ayres and Caroline looked at each other, thoroughly unnerved.
"What did you see?"
they asked Betty, and she answered with frightened eyes,
"I dunno, miss. Nothing at all. Only the smoke and the yellow flames coming up behind Mr. Roderick's back."
She seemed as bewildered as everyone else. After thinking the matter over, they could only conclude, doubtfully, that one of the cinders she had combed from Roderick's hair still had the germ of a fire in it, and the dryness of the newspaper had encouraged it back into life. Naturally, this was a very disturbing thought. They began to glance nervously about, half expecting other flames. Roderick in particular was distressed and panicky. When his mother said that perhaps she, Caroline, and Betty ought to go back up to his room for another rake at the ashes, he cried out desperately that they mustn't leave him alone. He was afraid to be on his own. He couldn't stop it. So, mainly in fear of his breaking down altogether, they took him with them. They found him an undamaged chair, and he sat in that, with his legs drawn up, his hands at his mouth, his eyes darting, while they went wearily from one blackened surface to another. But all was cold and dead and filthy. They gave up searching just before dawn. I woke an hour or two later, rather wearied by my bad dreams, but blissfully ignorant of the catastrophe that had very nearly swallowed up Hundreds Hall in the night. In fact, I knew nothing of the fire until I heard of it from one of my evening patients, who in turn had had the damage reported to him by a tradesman who'd been out at the house that morning. I didn't believe him at first. It seemed impossible to me that the family could have gone through such an ordeal and not sent me word of it. Then another man mentioned the incident to me as if it were already common knowledge. Still dubious, I telephoned Mrs. Ayres, and to my amazement she confirmed the whole story. She sounded so hoarse and so tired I cursed myself for not having called her sooner, when I might have gone out there. For I had recently started spending an evening a week on the wards of the district hospital. Tonight was one of those evenings, and I simply could not get away. She promised me that she, Caroline, and Roderick were all quite well, only weary. She said the fire had given them all a little fright. That was how she phrased it, and perhaps because of those words I pictured the incident as something relatively minor. I remembered all too vividly the state that Rod had been in when I had left him. I recalled the bullishness with which he'd been slopping his drinks around, the way he had dropped a lighted spill so that it burned unheeded on the carpet. I supposed he'd started a small blaze with a cigarette, but I knew that even a small fire can produce a great deal of smoke. I knew, too, that the effects of smoke inhalation are often at their worst a day or two after the fire itself, so I went to bed, worried about the family, and passed another uneasy night on their behalf. I drove out to the house at the end of my round next morning, and just as I'd feared, they were all suffering. In purely physical terms, Betty and Roderick were the least affected. She had kept close to the door while the fire was raging, and had been darting back and forth to the lavatory for water. Roderick had been lying flat in his bed, breathing shallowly, while the worst of the smoke collected high above his head. But Mrs. Ayres was by now quite wretched, breathless and weak, and more or less confined to her room, and Caroline looked and sounded ghastly, with a swollen throat and singed hair, and her face and hands marked crimson from embers and sparks. She met me at the front door as I arrived, and the sight of her was so awful, and so much worse than I'd been expecting. I found myself putting down my bag so that I could take her by the shoulders and gaze properly into her face. "Oh, Caroline," I said. She blinked self-consciously and smiled, but her sore-looking eyes began to glisten with tears.
"I look like a poor Guy Fawkes," she said, "that got snatched off the bonfire at the very last minute."
She turned away and started coughing. I said hastily, "Go in, for heaven's sake, out of the cold." By the time I had picked up my bag and joined her, her cough had subsided. She had wiped her face, and the tears were gone. I closed the door, but I did it blindly, shocked now by the frightful scent of burning which met me in the hall, shocked by the appearance of the hall itself, which might have been hung with mourning veils, so thickly spotted and smeared was every surface with smuts and blacks and soot.
"Horrible, isn't it?" said Caroline hoarsely, following my gaze. "And it only gets worse, I'm afraid. Come and see."
She led me along the north passage.
"The smell's right through the house, even up in the attics. I don't know how. Don't mind your muddy shoes. We've given up on this floor for now. But be careful of your jacket against the walls. The soot sticks like anything."
The door of Rod's room was ajar, and as we drew closer to it, I could see enough to prepare me for the devastation that lay beyond. Even so, when Caroline went in for a second, I stayed at the threshold, too appalled to follow. Mrs. Baisley, who was in there with Betty, washing down the walls, met my gaze and nodded grimly.
"You look like I done, doctor," she said, "when I come in yesterday morning. Well, this is nothing to how it were then. We was whiting in filth up to our ankles, weren't we, Betty?"
The room had been cleared of most of its furniture, which was standing higgledy-piggledy down on the terrace on the other side of the open French window. The carpet had also been rolled up and moved out, and sheets of newspaper had been laid on the wide wooden floorboards. But the boards were still so wet and ashy, the paper was turning to a thick grey pulp, like sooty porridge. The walls were running with more ashy water, where Mrs. Baisley and Betty were scrubbing at them. The wooden panelling was scorched and charred, and the ceiling, that notorious latticework ceiling, was perfectly black, its mysterious smudges lost forever. "This is unbelievable," I said to Caroline. "I had no idea. If I had known..." I didn't finish, for my knowing or not knowing was beside the point. There was nothing I could have done. But I felt horribly unsettled to think that such a serious thing could have happened to the family in my absence. I said, "The whole house might have been lost. It doesn't bear thinking about. And Rod was here, in the middle of it? Is he really all right?" She gave me, I thought, an odd sort of look, then glanced over at Mrs. Baisley.
"Yes, he's all right, only wheezy like the rest of us. Most of his things have been lost, though. His chair, you can see it out there, seemed to get the worst of the fire. That, and his desk and his table."
I looked through the open window and saw the desk, its legs and drawers intact, but its surfaces blackened and crisped as if someone had lit a bonfire on it. Suddenly I understood why there was so much ash in the room. I said, "His papers?" Caroline nodded tiredly.
"Probably the driest things in the house."
"Were any spared?"
"A few. I don't know what's been lost. I don't really know what was in here. There were plans of the house and estate, weren't there? I think there were all sorts of maps, copies of the deeds to the farms and cottages and letters and bills. Notes of my father's?"
Her voice grew thicker. She began to cough again. "What a dreadful, dreadful shame," I said, looking around and seeing new damage with every glance. A painting on the wall with its canvas charred, lamps with blackened globes and lustres. "This lovely room. What will you do with it? Can it be saved? The worst of the panels might be replaced, I suppose. The ceiling you could whitewash." She gave a gloomy shrug.
"Mother thinks that once the room has been cleaned, we might as well just close it up like the others. We certainly don't have the money to restore it."
"What about insurance money?" She glanced again at Mrs. Baisley and Betty. They were still scrubbing at the walls, and under cover of the rasp of their brushes, she said quietly,
"Rod let the insurance payments go. We just found out."
"He let them go?"
"Months ago, apparently, as a way of saving money."
She closed her eyes and slowly shook her head, then moved to the French window.
"Come outside for a minute, would you?"
We went down the stone steps, and I surveyed the damaged furniture, the ruined desk and table, the armchair with its leather covering gone, its springs and horsehair stuffing laid bare like the diseased bones and intestines of some fantastic anatomical model. It made very bleak viewing, and the day, though rainless, was cold. I saw Caroline shiver. I wanted to examine her and Betty, along with her mother and brother, so I said she ought to take me back into the house, to the little parlour or somewhere warm. But after a slight hesitation she looked in through the open window, then drew me further away from it. She coughed again, grimacing against her swollen throat as she swallowed. she said very quietly.
"You spoke to Mother yesterday. Did she say anything to you about how the fire might have started?"
She kept her eyes on mine. I said, "She told me only that it had broken out in Rod's room after all of you had gone to bed, and that you found it and put it out. I guessed that Rod, being so drunk, had done something silly with a cigarette."
"We thought the same," she said, "at first."
I was struck by that, at first. I said warily, "What does Rod himself remember?"
"Nothing at all."
"I suppose he passed out. And then, what? Could he have woken later, gone to the fire, lit a spill?" She swallowed uncomfortably again and spoke with something of an effort.
"I don't know. I just don't know what to think."
She nodded back in through the window.
"Did you notice the fireplace?"
I looked and saw the grate covered over with a grey mesh guard. Caroline said,
"That's exactly how it was when I left Rod a few hours before the fire started. When I went back in, the grate was dark, as if it hadn't been disturbed. But the other fires, well, I keep picturing them. There wasn't just one, you see. There were, I don't know, maybe five or six."
"As many as that?" I said, shocked. "It's a miracle, Caroline, that none of you is more seriously hurt."
"That isn't what I mean. They taught us about fire in the Wrens. They talked about how fire spreads. It creeps, you know. It doesn't leap. These fires, they were more like the separate small fires that might have been started by incendiaries or something. Look at Rod's chair. It's as though flames broke out right in the middle of it. The legs are untouched. The desk and table are the same. And these curtains."
She caught up the pair of brocade curtains that had burned themselves free from their rings, and which had been slung over the back of the ruined armchair.
"The fire starts here, look, halfway up. How can that be? The walls to either side of them are only scorched. It's as if—"
She glanced back into the room, more afraid than ever of being overheard.
"Well, Rod's having been careless with a cigarette or a candle is one thing, but it's as if these fires were set. Deliberately set, I mean."
I said, appalled, "You think that Rod—" She answered quickly,
"I don't know. I simply don't know. But I've been thinking about what he told you that time at your surgery, and those marks we found on his walls. They were burns, weren't they? Well, weren't they? They make a horrible sort of sense now. Besides, there's another thing."
And then she told me about that odd little incident down in the kitchen, when the parcel of newspaper had apparently burst into flame behind Rod's back. At the time, as I've reported, they'd all supposed it the work of a cinder. But since then Caroline had gone to have another look at the scene and had found a box of kitchen matches on one of the shelves close by. She didn't think it very likely, but it seemed to her just possible that, with no one's eyes upon him, Roderick could have got hold of one of the matches and started the blaze himself. This seemed to me to be simply too much. I said, "I don't want to doubt you, Caroline, but you'd all been through such an ordeal. I'm not surprised you saw more flames."
"You think we imagined the burning paper? All four of us?"
"Well,
we didn't imagine it, I promise you that. The flames were real, and if Roddy didn't start them, then what did? That's what scares me, almost more than anything. That's why I think it has to have been Rod."
I didn't quite know what she was getting at, but she was plainly very frightened. I said, "Look, let's be calm about this. There's no proof, is there, that the fire was anything other than an accident?" She said,
"I'm not so sure. I wonder, for instance, what a policeman would make of it. You heard that Paget's man was out here yesterday, bringing the meat? He smelt the smoke and wandered round to look through the windows before I could stop him. He was a fireman in Coventry during the war, you know. I told him some slush about an oil heater, but I saw him having a good look round, taking everything in. I could see in his face that he didn't believe me."
"But what you're suggesting," I said softly, "is monstrous. To think of Rod, cold-heartedly going about the room."
"I know. I know it's horrible. And I don't say he did it deliberately, Doctor. I don't believe he wanted to hurt anyone. I'll believe anything but that. But, well—"
Her expression grew pinched and desperately unhappy.
"Can't people do hurtful things sometimes and not even know they're doing them?"
I didn't answer. I looked around me again at the ruined furniture, the chair, the table, the desk with its charred and ashy surface, over which I had so often seen Rod poring in a state very like despair. I remembered how, a few hours before the fire, he had been raging against his father, against his mother, against the whole estate. "There'll be tricks tonight," he had said to me, with dreadful coyness, and I'd looked from him, hadn't I, into the shadows of his room, and seen the walls and ceiling of it marked, almost swarming with those unnerving black smudges. I passed a hand across my face. "Oh, Caroline," I said, "what a ghastly business. I can't help but feel responsible." She said,
"What do you mean?"
"I should never have left your brother alone. I let him down. I've let you all down. Where is he now? What does he say?" Her look grew odd again.
"We've put him upstairs in his old room. But listen, we can't get anything sensible out of him. He's in pretty dreadful shape. We think we can rely on Betty, but we don't want Mrs. Baisley to see him. We don't want anyone to see him if we can help it. The Rossiters called yesterday, and I had to send them away in case he made some sort of fuss. It isn't shock, it's something else. Mother's taken his cigarettes and everything like that. She's—"
Her eyelids fluttered, and a little blood crept into her cheeks.
"She's locked him in."
"Locked him in?" I couldn't believe it.
"She's been thinking about the fire, you see, like I have. She supposed it an accident at first. We all did. Then, from the way he was behaving and the things he said, it was clear that something else was going on. I had to tell her about the other things. Now she's afraid of what he'll do next."
She turned away and started coughing, and this time the cough would not subside. She had spoken too long and too feelingly, and the day was too cold. She looked terribly weary and ill. I took her through to the little parlour, and it was there that I examined her. Then I went upstairs to look at her mother and her brother. I went to Mrs. Eyre's first. She was propped up against her pillows, swathed in bed-jackets and shawls, her long hair loose about her shoulders, making her face seem pale and pinched, but she was clearly very glad to see me.
"Oh, Dr. Faraday," she said hoarsely, "can you believe this new calamity? I'm beginning to think my family must have some sort of curse upon it. I don't understand it. What have we done? Whom have we angered? Do you know?"
She asked this almost seriously. I said, as I hitched up a chair and began to examine her, "You've certainly had more than your share of bad luck. I'm so sorry." She coughed, leaning forward to do it, then sinking back into her pillows, but she held my gaze.
"You've seen Roderick's room?"
I was moving the stethoscope. "Just a second, please." "Yes."
"You saw the desk, the chair?"
"Do try not to speak for a moment." I drew her forward again in order to listen at her back. Then, putting my stethoscope away and feeling her eyes still on me, I nodded. "Yes."
"And what do you make of them?"
"I don't know."
"I think you do. And, oh, Doctor, I never imagined I would live to be afraid of my own son. I keep picturing what might have happened. Every time I close my eyes, I see flames."
Her voice caught. Another fit of coughing overtook her, more serious than the first, and she couldn't finish. I held her shoulders as she shook, then gave her water to sip and a clean handkerchief with which to wipe her mouth and eyes. She fell back into her pillows again, flushed and exhausted. I said, "You're talking too much." She shook her head.
"I have to speak. I've no one to discuss this with save you and Caroline, and she and I have been talking each other in circles. She told me things yesterday. Extraordinary things. I couldn't believe it. She said that Roderick's been behaving almost like a madman, that his room was burned before this, that she showed you the marks."
I moved uncomfortably. "She showed me something, yes."
"You wouldn't come to me, either of you?"
"We didn't want to unsettle you. We wanted to spare you if we could. Naturally, if I had had any idea that Roderick's condition would lead to something like this—" Her expression grew unhappier.
"His condition, you call it. So you knew he was ill?"
I said, "I knew he wasn't well. To be frank, I suspected he was far from well, but I made him a promise."
"He came to you, I think, and told you some tale about this house. About there being something in it, wishing him harm? Is that true?"
I hesitated. She saw and said, with humble earnestness,
"Please be honest with me, Doctor."
So I said, "Yes, it's true, I'm sorry." And I recounted everything that had happened. Rod's fit of panic in my dispensary, his bizarre and frightening story, his sulkiness and temper since then, the threats implicit in some of his words. She listened in silence, putting out her hand after a moment and blindly catching hold of mine. Her fingernails, I saw, were ridged and elderly and still dirty with soot. Her knuckles were marked from flying embers, the scars a little echo of her son's. Her grip grew tighter the more she learned, and when I had finished speaking she looked at me as if bewildered.
"My poor dear boy. I had no idea. He was never strong like his father, I knew that. But to think of his mind giving way like this. Did he really..."
She put her other hand to her breast.
"Did he really speak like that against hundreds? Against me?"
I said, "You see, this is precisely why I hesitated to tell you. He wasn't himself when he said those things. He hardly knew what he was saying." She seemed not to have heard me.
"Can it be true that he hates us all so much? Is that why this has happened?"
"No, no. It's clearly the strain." She looked more bewildered than ever.
"The strain?"
"The house, the farm, the aftershock of his accident, his time in the service. Who knows? Does it matter what's caused it?" Again she didn't seem to be listening. She clutched my fingers and said, as if really anguished,
"Tell me, Doctor, am I to blame?"
The question, and the obvious force of emotion behind it, surprised me. I said,
"Of course you aren't."
"But I'm his mother. This is his home. For this thing to have happened, it isn't natural. It isn't right. I must have failed him in some way. Have I? Suppose there was something, Dr. Faraday."
She drew away her hand and lowered her eyes as if ashamed.
"Suppose there were something," she went on, "that had got in the way of my feelings for him when he was a boy. Some shadow of upset or grief."
Her voice flattened.
"I expect you know that I once had another child, before Caroline and Roderick were born. My little girl, Susan."
I nodded. "I remember it. I'm sorry." She made a gesture, turning her head, acknowledging my sympathy, but also shrugging it off, as if it could have no bearing on her grief. She said, in the same almost matter-of-fact way as before,
"She was my one true love. Does that sound odd to you? I never expected, when I was young, that I should fall in love with my own child, but she and I were like sweethearts. When she died, I felt for a long time that I might as well have died with her. Perhaps I did. People told me that the best and soonest way to get over the loss of a child was to start another, as quickly as one could. My mother told me that, my mother-in-law, my aunts, my sister. And then, when Caroline was born, they said something else. They said, 'Well, naturally, a little girl will put you in mind of the lost one. You must try again. You must try for a boy. A mother always loves her sons.' And after Roderick, 'Why, what's the matter with you? Don't you know that people of our sort don't make a fuss? Here you are in your fine home with your husband who came through the war and two healthy children. If you can't find a way to be happy with that, you must simply stop complaining.'"
Again she coughed and wiped her eyes. I said, when the cough had subsided, "It was hard for you."
"Harder for my children?"
"Don't say that. Love isn't a thing that can be weighed and measured, surely."
"Perhaps you're right. And yet, I do love my children, Doctor, truly I do. But what a very dull and half-alive thing that love has seemed to me sometimes, because I have been half-alive, you see. Caroline, I think, it hasn't harmed. Roderick was always the sensitive one. Could it be that he grew up feeling a sort of falseness in me and hating me for it?"
I thought of how Rod himself had spoken on the night of the fire. I remembered him saying that he and his sister had disappointed his mother simply by being born. But her expression now was so anguished, and I had already told her so much. What good would it have done to share that with her too? So I took her hand again and said very firmly, "You're being fanciful. You're ill and tired. One upset summons up a crowd of others, that's all it is." She looked into my face, wanting to believe me.
"You really think so?"
"I know so. You mustn't brood on things from the past. The issue we've to deal with now is not what's made Rod ill, but how we're to get him well again.
But suppose this is too deep.